low-income women in Alaska can continue to get assistance in paying for an abortion.
A court ruling strikes down a state law limiting access to abortion. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, August 27th. Good evening, I'm Ann Hillman. Also tonight, the Anchorage mayor says downtown will be open for business when President Obama is around.
The disruption will be minimal and our opportunities to show off our city are going to be rather profound.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
And by
Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the field. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
The Alaska Superior Court today struck down a state law that would have limited Medicaid coverage of abortions for low-income women. The judge found the law, which imposes a strict definition of medically necessary abortion, violates the equal protection guarantees of Alaska's Constitution. Laura Einstein is legal counsel for Planned Parenthood of the Great Northwest, which filed the lawsuit.
Extremely gratified that low-income women in Alaska can continue to get assistance in paying for an abortion if they need to have one and their doctor agrees that it will be beneficial to their health.
Planned Parenthood is the largest provider of abortions in Alaska. In 2014, it administered about 1,400. Of those, about 400 were covered by Medicaid. In order to qualify for Medicaid reimbursement, a procedure needs to be medically necessary as determined by a physician. In 2014, the Alaska legislature defined medically necessary with a list of specific health conditions. The court struck down that definition.
What the court found was that requiring women to have a health condition that was dire, that was essentially one where their life was at risk, was too high a standard and too fundamentally different than the standard that would be applied for the provision of other health services in the Medicaid program.
Republican Senator John Coghill sponsored the bill that defines what's medically necessary. He says he's very disappointed with the court's decision, although he hasn't read it yet.
I think it shows that quite often judges come to a decision based on their own political philosophies. I think it's just very, very evident in this particular case.
Coghill says the state shouldn't pay for abortions that don't meet the criteria under his law.
When it's medically necessary, there's a reasonable cause. When it's not medically necessary and it's more optional, then I think people should carry the load of their own decisions.
A spokesperson with the state attorney general's office says the agency is still reviewing the decision and doesn't know if it will appeal. Superior Court Judge Frank Fifner heard oral arguments this afternoon in Anchorage in the Legislative Council's case against Governor Bill Walker to stop Medicaid expansion. The council filed suit Monday to stop the program from going forward as planned next week, saying the governor doesn't have the authority to expand Medicaid on his own. Aaron Murphy, a lawyer for the Legislative Council, spoke by Skype from Washington, D.C., where she's based. She said the case wasn't about whether Medicaid expansion was a good thing for the state of Alaska, but about, quote, who has the power to make that decision. Lawyers for the state argued the council failed to prove the legislature would face irreparable harm if Medicaid expansion takes effect on September 1st. That's required for the judge to issue the temporary restraining order the legislature is seeking. Judge Fifner says he'll issue an oral decision tomorrow at noon. Both sides and the judge agree no matter how Fifner rules, the case is headed to the state Supreme Court. British Columbia's top mining official says he's open to involving his federal government in transboundary mine conflicts. That's a change from earlier statements. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld has been following a series of mine meetings this week in Juneau. He filed this report.
BC Mines Minister Bill Bennett went into the meeting saying the U.S.-Canada Boundary Waters Treaty wasn't the right place to address mining concerns. The treaty allows the countries to convene a commission to examine and resolve the potential for BC mineral extraction to damage Alaska fisheries. Then he spent 3 days touring the transboundary Taku River and meeting with tribal fisheries and environmental critics, as well as state lawmakers and officials. At a Wednesday press conference with Lieutenant Governor Byron Mallott, Bennett said he's more open to the idea.
We think that we can resolve most of the uncertainties by working closely with Alaska. I think you get more done at kind of the local state province level, but I would not foreclose or dismiss the future opportunity to involve the federal governments if they can help.
Mallott is actively pursuing federal involvement. At the press conference, he said he'd lobby the U.S. Secretary of State during his upcoming visit to Alaska.
I will seek a meeting with Secretary Kerry in order to hopefully gain the commitment of the Secretary that his department will maintain an awareness, will be ready to engage if and when asked, because we never know where this ultimately will take us.
Mallott admitted a meeting is unlikely, but he said he'll push for the State Department, which must initiate a request, to leverage involvement of the International Joint Commission, which addresses cross-boundary water issues. Mallott and Bennett said their meetings were productive and built trust. Both brought up plans for a memorandum of understanding addressing exchanges of information and expanded Alaska involvement in BC's permit system. Mine critics, in a follow-up press conference, agreed that the meetings were a step in the right direction, but they weren't enough. John Morris of the Douglas Indian Association and the United Tribal Transboundary Mining Work Group said a memorandum of understanding is no more than a formal handshake.
We have to move beyond that and start getting something in writing, a good, solid, legal contract between our parties to prevent these kind of disasters from happening.
Morris was joined by environmental and fisheries leaders. Heather Hardcastle of Salmon Beyond Borders and Taku River Reds said she will continue pushing for both countries' federal government's involvement.
The International Joint Commission, to us, is the best forum to go about with equal numbers of experts on both sides of the border to look at what has gone on already in the region and what can go on in the future given these proposed and operating mines.
Hardcastle and the others said they were encouraged by British Columbia leaders' willingness to listen during the week's meetings. They also praised the Mallott-Walker administration for opening up its own process to get a broader view of BC mining's potential impacts to Southeast Alaska. This is Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau.
Next week, downtown Anchorage will be crawling with dignitaries who will be in town for an international conference hosted by the State Department. Mayor Ethan Berkowitz today announced which streets will be closed for security. He says residents should be flexible when visiting downtown for the first half of the week. But as APRN's Liz Ruskin reports, he says it won't be that bad.
Secretary of State John Kerry and Interior Secretary Sally Jewell are coming to Anchorage, as are a boatload of Nordic diplomats. The foreign ministers of Sweden, Denmark, Finland, Norway, and Iceland are all on the agenda for Monday's conference. Oh yeah, and the President of the United States is coming. The street closures are focused on two buildings, the Denina Center and the Hotel Captain Cook. Streets bordering them will close to traffic. Some parking spots will be off limits and some stretches closed even to pedestrians. Looking beyond the inconvenience, Mayor Berkowitz says the event allows Anchorage residents to show the world they can be great hosts.
For a bit of time, downtown Anchorage is going to be a little bit more of a walking community than it has been, but businesses are going to remain open. The disruption will be minimal, and our opportunities to show off our city are going to be rather profound.
The closures begin Monday morning at 6. They'll remain up around the Captain Cook until noon Wednesday, presumably because that's where the president is staying while he visits Seward, Dillingham, and Kotzebue. The White House has provided few details about his itinerary. The opacity is a typical feature of high-level security. Police Chief Mark Mew says officers are not going to clear the parks or turn downtown into an airport-style security zone.
There will be places where we will tell you you can't walk, as you just can't go there. But we're not setting up some sort of screening stations for pedestrians.
Conference organizers, though, have warned reporters to expect security checkpoints at entrances to the Denina Center. Chief Mews says he can't provide an estimate of how much the increased police presence will cost, citing security reasons. He says the city's request for federal reimbursement hasn't been granted. Municipal traffic engineer Stephanie Mormillo says she knows people will want to come downtown and participate in the presidential excitement, and she says they should.
I hope everybody is patient and respectful. I mean, obviously there's going to be impacts. Hopefully they will be minimized as much as possible, but traffic patterns are going to be different than normal. So pay attention to signage, pay attention to barricades, and just be respectful of those who are trying to direct you and of other drivers and pedestrians around you.
The municipality's homepage has a link to closure maps and schedules. You can also find a link on our website, alaskapublic.org. Reporting from Anchorage, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a Homer couple is working to produce local garlic.
Instead of importing our seed from the lower 48, for our resilience in Alaska, wouldn't it be nice if there was a grower who sold varieties in Alaska?
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Spinard Builder Supply. For more than 60 years, SBS has helped Alaskans build from ground to roof to everything in between. Spinard Builder Supply is here to build with you.
And by
Alaska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977.
Science was in the spotlight when the U.S. Arctic Research Commission came together in Nome for its second and final day of meetings. They covered a range of topics, from fire forecasts and walrus tagging to sea ice loss and the nutritional value of reindeer meat. Federal researchers highlighted what makes their work relevant to the region. Karen Murphy is coordinator of the Western Alaska Landscape Conservation Cooperative, which is developing a model to predict storm surges, tides, ice movement, and more in the Bering, Chukchi, and Beaufort Seas.
When the National Weather Service says, expect a storm surge of 4 feet over mean high water levels, what does that mean on the ground? What does that mean for actually affecting the communities? These maps will help people interpret that.
Murphy says, the goal is to get information to the people who will use it in an easy-to-use format. That means maps and other tools will be available online. Murphy says the information will also be broken down by region, so locals can find forecasts specific to Norton Sound or the Seward Peninsula, rather than all of Western Alaska. The National Park Service is also doing research on the Seward Peninsula, monitoring the migration of brown bears, muskox, caribou, and other animals. NPS researcher Jim Lawler says tracking species provides valuable information for locals as well as larger agencies.
If local users or local subsistence users aren't getting caribou, is it because there's not very many caribou, or is it because the caribou are in a different location than the people are?
The Park Service is creating caribou migration maps that can answer that question. But Lawler says professional biologists aren't the only ones getting involved. The National Park Service has recruited students at the Shishmaref School to help photograph migratory birds to get better on-the-ground information and engage local people. Fran Ulmer is chair of the U.S. Arctic Research Commission and says gaining local insight is key to successful Arctic policy.
And in Alaska, particularly where subsistence is such an important part of life, to better understand how changing ecosystems, how changing species populations, migrations, etc., connect with choices that are being made on the ground by both managers but also subsistence hunters and fishers and gatherers is a really important way of making sure that the federal government is spending its money wisely when it comes to research.
The commission advises the White House and Congress on Arctic issues. Local garbage bandits have been making their bi-yearly rounds in Ketchikan, leaving messes in their wake. KRBD's Madeline Beck reports on how residents are and should be warding off these hungry bears.
There are grizzly bears and brown bears and black bears, and there are garbage bears. More than a few Ketchikan residents have woken to this sound, quite aware that it's probably a bear looking for a free meal.
Well, we moved in the winter, so we really had no clue. And then the first summer hit, and it just got bad.
This is Jen Tucker. She lives near a landfill in the area that she affectionately calls Dump Hill. She says she's been plagued by bears nearly every night of every summer.
And we've been here 7 years now. Yeah, it would be almost every 2 hours the bears would be back.
She says one night she had a bear pushing its nose up against the screen door of her house, and she zapped it with an electrified fly swatter. Even that didn't keep the bear away.
And then later that night, he broke into my car and ripped out my seat and took a nap in the back seat. And I don't think he was after food, because there was a peanut butter and jelly sandwich he didn't eat.
Just revenge.
Revenge.
She says she's given up on fortifying her garbage cans and taken up another method.
We built an enclosure. He ripped that apart. You can see the wood pile. We used to use chains and straps on the trash cans, and he actually literally ripped a lid in half. And so we've kind of given up. This year, we just go to the dump every day.
Ketchikan Solid Waste Superintendent Lenny Neely says that Tucker's case is unusual, and he has only ever seen one bear-destroyed garbage lid. He says the best bet is to buy a ratchet strap.
To keep the lid tightly sealed, and it minimizes odors and material from falling out. I mean, I've seen them flip the cans over, jump up and down, and they're like, enough of this, and they just head on down the street.
Neely says putting stinky meat or fish garbage in the freezer until garbage day is best, better even than having an expensive bear-proof can. He says big bears can dent lids on many of those so-called bear-proof containers and render them useless. Alaska Department of Fish and Game biologist Boyd Porter says that the first taste is what leads to problem bears. Oftentimes, he says it's bad for the bears in the end.
Once people train them, then a lot of times either myself, the Alaska State Troopers, or the Ketchikan Police Department will have to go in and kill the bear.
Porter says they've killed as many as 15 bears during a particularly bad year. He says there are about 30 bears around the Ketchikan area this year, and he really doesn't want to kill any of them. He says if garbage cans are secure, with either ratchet straps or an enclosure, a bear might look around, but won't stick around. Ketchikan Police Chief Alan Bengard says it's the bears that start standing their ground that must be shot.
After a period of time, they get so familiar with being around humans that they don't back down. They will stand their ground on territory, and at that point in time, they're becoming a danger.
Bengard says there's usually only one or two bears a year in the city that need to be killed, but police end up chasing off a lot of bears with rubber bullets and even tasers. He says there is one bear in town right now hanging around 3rd Avenue that is becoming a problem.
I actually run into one of the bears that we're having issues with, and he's a big bear. I mean, he's probably upper 300-pound range.
Just walking down the street?
Yeah, in broad daylight. So he's pretty comfortable around people.
Bengard says the law states that garbage is supposed to be put out no earlier than 4 a.m. the day of garbage pickup. He says that they have some leniency with that, but that they're serious about people who don't secure those garbage cans. Citations are $200 each. So far this year, he says he's only given out warnings, but also says this is one of the busiest times and is getting busier. Jen Tucker says she knows bears will be around foraging every night for at least a few more weeks, but she says she doesn't mind too much.
It's worth it. I mean, look where I get to live. I've got this gorgeous view. I live here, and I don't know, other places have raccoons, rats. We have bears. Our rodents are just bigger.
Reporting from Ketchikan, I'm Madeline Beck.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Raven Alaska, connecting Alaska's business travelers across the state for more than 50 years. Find more at flyraven.com.
These days, being into STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math, doesn't make a girl a geek. It makes the world a better place. If you like numbers, nature, computers, and figuring out how the world really works, go to beanengineeralaska.com. You just might like what you learn. And it's not just for girls. This message on Alaska Public Media brought to you by ExxonMobil in Alaska.
A farming couple in Homer is trying to change the way the state grows garlic by developing special strains resilient to the northern climate. KBBI's Shady Grove Oliver has more.
Lori Jenkins and her husband, Wayne, live on a farm tucked away in the Fritz Creek area outside of Homer called Synergy Gardens. She's standing in a large shed. On the back wall, rows and rows of garlic are hanging to dry. She pulls some of them down.
Well, the soft necks, this is a Nootka Rose variety. I've already dried them for 3 weeks and cleaned off the root and clean the stems, and I'm going to make some braids.
She deftly weaves them together with rosemary sprigs. She says nowadays, people are used to buying pre-peeled garlic at the store and sometimes are a bit wary of buying a whole head, but the braid makes it extra special.
To me, there's nothing like garlic braid. You're not only are you bringing something beautiful to their kitchen, but something that tastes delicious. And then when they go and cook it, it smells so good.
The Nootka Rose that she's using today is one of three varieties of softneck garlic she's growing this year, along with Silver Skin and Red Toque. Garlic is grown around the world, from Siberia to Guatemala, with different varieties acclimating best to warmer or colder environments. The standard grocery store garlic is a softneck, usually artichoke or silver white, much of which is grown in Gilroy, California, known as the garlic capital of the U.S. Softnecks do well in warmer places. They mature quickly and stay good for a long time.
Most Alaskan gardeners advised me not to grow the softneck. They said it won't grow good in Alaska.
Typically, hardnecks fare better in areas with cold winters, often making them the go-to type for Alaskan growers.
I realized more research needs to be done, and our weather is shifting. Global warming is happening, and the change is causing earlier springs and longer falls. And with that, the success of softnecks is possible. I thought, well, instead of importing our seed from the lower 48 for our resilience in Alaska, wouldn't it be nice if there was a grower who sold varieties that were successful in Alaska?
And that was the start of what she's named the Alaska Garlic Project. She wants to develop strains of garlic perfectly suited to both the cold winters and long summers of the state. Out in the open-air garlic beds, her husband Wayne is digging up heads.
I'm using a broad fork, which speeds up the harvest of the garlic, getting it broken up out of the soil so that you can pull the roots without breaking off the stem so they can be hung up to be dried.
He knocks the excess dirt off of one and lays it down in the long row of garlic behind him. He says he wishes they could grow several times what they have now, but they're still in the research and development phase of their project.
But it's all dependent on markets. You know, if we can find out which varieties perform the best for our area of Alaska, and then, you know, build a website and find out what the size of the market is for fresh garlic cloves. You could refer to it as seed if you wanted to. You know, we're not going to just go crazy and overplant. You know, it's all dependent on whether we can develop different markets for it.
Cultivating business is the next step. For now, Lori has already graded out the best of this year's crop, which came from last year's, which was seed from 2 years ago. That means come next summer, she'll have third-year Alaskan cultivated garlic.
It's like apples. You know, we grew up on Red Delicious and Granny Greens, and all of a sudden now we're in love with Galas and Pink Ladies, and the different varieties of apples are more popular than your old-time favorites. So just because we knew that garlic was good from Gilroy, I think we're ready to try new varieties for flavor, taste, and sensations.
And show it can be done right here on home soil. In Homer, I'm Shady Grove Oliver.
The morning at Brother Francis Shelter starts with a sleepy bustle. Guests wake up at 5 a.m., start gathering their belongings, drink some coffee, and help clean the shelter. One morning in late July, in the back dormitory, I joined shelter guest William Teal as he wiped down the plastic sleeping mats with cleaning solution. 50-year-old Teal chats a little bit about his life at the shelter. His job is to disinfect the mats, but he also volunteers to help unplug the toilets and pick up trash. He's been at Brother Francis for about 4 months this time. He arrived with nothing but a change of clothes and $14. He's been in and out of the shelter for decades.
I mean, I used to be one of the guys out here drinking, drugging, you know, living out in the campsites, being in the same clothes days on end. Now I shower every day, change my clothes every day. I shave. You know, it's the small things.
He He says he's rediscovered God and is working hard to stay sober. It takes him less than 3 minutes to turn the conversation to his favorite topic, his three-year-old son. Tia launches into stories about the mischievous boy's antics, how he protects his lunch from marauding geese, darts through library bookshelves to elude his father, and battles the puppet embodiment of the big bad wolf.
Well, he smacks the puppet with his fist. It comes off the lady's hand and goes and drops. He steps back and field kicks it across the room. 30 kids in there, ages probably 3 to 8, all jumped up with their arms straight up in the air, was like, yeah, all screaming. Around looks at me and goes, bad doggy, because it looked like a little dog, and it scared him.
Teal is trying hard to regain custody of the boy from the Office of Children's Services. He's working part-time, putting away money, securing housing, and taking fatherhood classes from Cook Inlet Tribal Council.
I'm doing whatever I can to keep me with my son. That's my foundation and my rock right now.
He says he tries to stay occupied from the moment he wakes up, leaving the shelter as soon as he's done with his sanitation jobs.
I hate to say it, but it's the truth. If I sit down here all the time and I'm with all these people, I start feeling depressed. I start listening to stories, you start feeling sad. And it makes you want to go drink or do something, you know, or be lazy. So I get up and usually go. And if anything else, if I don't have anything else to do, I try to make good with my time. I go to the library.
He reads, goes to church twice a week, works on his resume, and meets with caseworkers who he says are helping him despite their massive caseloads.
You know, they can't take the time every day to sit down and say hi or to be cordial or nice. But when they do take the time and just make the appointment, you know, but it has to be our effort. We have to be the ones to be willing to take that effort to do it.
He says his son gives him the motivation to get his life back on track.
This is my last chance. So now I'm going to actually watch this kid grow up. You know, I don't know how much God's got me left for this world, but my plan is to be with him and help raise him.
And Teal says, thanks to the skills he's learning, that may happen very soon. From the Urban Affairs Desk, I'm Ann Hillman. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Lisa Fu and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Laura Craigle in Nome, Madeline Beck in Ketchikan, and Shady Grove Oliver in Homer. APRN's Liz Ruskin and Annie Feit reported from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Monica Gokey is our web editor. And I'm Ann Hillman. Have a lovely night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
the Red Dog Mine, committed to environmental excellence. Alaska oil and gas have a huge impact on all of us, but how much do you really know about them? At akoilandgas.com, you can take an oil and gas IQ quiz and get the facts from reliable sources. This message sponsored by the Alaska Oil and Gas Association. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
Broken hips and head injuries can have life-altering effects, especially for older adults. But no matter how old you are, it's important to be physically active to prevent injuries. Activity can also increase your strength, balance, and can be done at any age. Ask your healthcare provider about activities that will improve your health. Learn more about starting a new activity at injuryprevention.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.